Welcome to Talking Book Publishing.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Book Publishing. I'm your host, Kathleen Kaiser, along with my co-host, Adana Moriarty. And today we have Rebecca Inch Partridge as our guest, and she's sort of a one-two punch, I think. Yes, because she is a book editor. That's her, like she says, her day job. But she also is a science fiction writer. So we want to talk first about book editing because it's a topic of mine that I don't think enough writers understand the importance of. They just think it's punctuation or something, which is so far out of the league. And then we're going to, after we talk about that for a while, we're going to discuss her new book. But anyway, welcome, Rebecca.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I'll tell you, I have learned so much since listening to your guys' show. And I was just telling Adana, my to-do list just got a lot longer of what I need to do to promote my book, but I'm grateful to finally find some good advice.
Oh, well, thank you. We try. That's sort of our day job. So is promoting books and figuring out what to do and help people with the Writers and Publishers Network. It's really being a resource where they can do things. And then with our company, we promote authors' books. So, but let's get on to what you're doing. Now, tell us about this conference where you were recently on a panel and the topic and what you found interesting there.
So the wonderful thing in the science fiction community is that what everybody thinks of as sci-fi conventions, they think of like Star Trek fanzine conventions. But there's actually conventions where aspiring writers and established writers with scientists and fans, and we talk about the industry. And so this was a writing panel at BayCon, a science fiction convention. And the topic was what every editor wish authors knew. And we just covered some of the basics that most writers don't know they don't know. And so we were able to kind of dispel some myths, but also give authors an idea of stuff that they should do before they go paying for an editor, how to find a legitimate editor, and the difference in all the different types of editing, which most people don't even realize how many different types of editing there are.
So let's start with why do they need an editor?
So setting my bias aside, because that is my day job and it's how I make my living, one of the reasons that authors usually need an editor is that they're at a certain stage where they think the book is good enough. And they want to either get it traditionally published or they want to go to self-publishing. And a lot of authors don't realize before they go either of those avenues and before they even approach an editor, it's really good to have some beta readers, belong to a writer's group, get a second pair of eyeballs on it. But a lot of times the manuscript I get, the authors say, nobody's ever seen this before. And I just kind of go, then why are you spending your money paying an editor to go through your first draft? There comes a point when an editor, and I'm a developmental editor, so that's somebody who works on the overall plot, setting, character, the narrative style, the big picture stuff, to try to bring the book up to a breakout level. So taking a book that maybe was a C+, if you were going to grade it, and trying to get it up to a solid A. And a lot of authors, they miss some of the big glaring continuity errors, or they don't realize that their character is not engaging, that the reader is not going to care what happens to this person. Because they know what that character is in their mind, and they think that somehow or another the reader is going to connect the same way they do. And so having somebody who reads the genre, works in the genre, be able to give feedback on what's going to bring that book up to a publishable level is super important. And the other thing, which I'm really sad about, is that these days, when you go to agents or you go to traditional publishers that will accept unsolicited submissions, or maybe you're at a convention pitching it, a lot of times they ask, have you had this professionally edited? It is an expectation in the industry because most publishers no longer have editors who actually edit on staff. They have acquisition editors who buy, they have managing editors that run the money, but they now put it upon the author to get their work edited. And so it's an extra filtering step, but it's also something that has put a whole lot of very, very good, solid, experienced editors from being in-house editors to being freelancers. So, you know, in one respect, it makes it easier to find one.
But what do you think? Because one of the things I always say is don't hire a school teacher. they haven't worked in the industry. You need to know somebody who's worked in publishing, because book publishing has its own language and it's the way it does things. It's not like real strict grammar rules that you learned in fifth grade.
I actually had the experience of sending my manuscript to a proofreader after I had rewritten it, after I got notes from my editor, and she took all the contractions out of the dialogue because that's not proper English. So no, just because somebody is really good at English doesn't necessarily mean that they're a good proofreader. If they understand how novels are different than essays, they might be good at catching the punctuation and stuff for you, but that's a proofreader, which is a little different even than a copy editor, who's making sure that there is continuity throughout. So Bob doesn't have green eyes at the first part of the book and brown eyes in the middle of the book. And Lucinda isn't married to Ralph at one family reunion. And then all of a sudden Ralph's name changes to, you know, Reagan. And one of the things that came up in the panel on We Wish Authors Knew is the copy editing or the proofing is the very, very, very last step. It's before you actually submit it. And it should be fairly well developed. It should be solidly written at that point. Your character plot setting should all be good. All you're looking for is almost school teacher, you know, proper. And so the copy editor can catch things. You really need to send with that a cheat sheet. It's called a style sheet. And that's a list of all your characters and their main attributes so that that stays consistent throughout the novel. And all the other editors on the panel were like, oh, please, yes, please send a style sheet so that those kind of things aren't so time consuming and having to search back and double check everything.
When you were writing your own book, do you think you can edit yourself? I mean, you edit other people's books. I mean, can you catch your own continuity errors or no?
No. So I say the same thing as a lawyer. Editor who edits her own book has a fool for a client. My editor is at a level where she pushes me a little bit further towards that, what they call the breakout novel level, where you've got subplots and extra layers. And even in a YA book, you don't want it to be flat and simple. But she also gives it another pair of eyes, because a lot of times in science fiction, you know what you have imagined so well in your mind, what these races look like, what they talk like, what they're wearing, what the culture is like, what the world around them is like. And you simply forget to infuse that in the action of the scene. And we call it white room syndrome, where the background and the setting is completely blank. And so it is really good, no matter how good of a writer you are, even if you've worked as an editor, to have somebody else that you work with in order to help you catch things. And that's why I'm a big proponent of writers groups and getting work critiqued before you start paying the money to have it edited. Why would you pay somebody? And you know, the Editorial Freelancers Association, EFA, has the rate listed right up there publicly for people to see what a professional editor should charge. Why would you charge somebody $3 a page to do what for a first draft could have been done by having a couple beta readers. That's, you want something done at a level when you've gotten the book as good as you can with working with critique groups, beta readers, exchanging reading with another author, because there's just a lot of things you're not going to find.
Yeah, I found when I wrote my first novel, I had it all done, but then I spent 2 years with two different critique groups meeting monthly, and it really sharpened it up. I really enjoyed it. Only I think two people between both group, one person in each group had ever been published, but they were eyes looking at it and finding little errors, because I was back then I was very confused on who I wanted who to be. And I was changing names for the same character, and I had missed that completely. And wow. I caught all of those kind of mistakes, and it was really, really helpful. And of course, I've been writing my whole life. It was business writing, but I was used to an editor, correcting me. So I wasn't, the people that get offended, I don't understand that. Especially if it's your first book, you've never done this before. Editors are the biggest help I've ever had in improving my writing.
Well, and an editor, though, sometimes it's just not a good fit. So the way I work, and this is a little different than the average, but most of the time, if you're looking for an editor, you don't just flip through the yellow pages or just randomly pick one off the internet. One of the best ways to find a good editor is to ask an author in the genre you're in who their editor was. And that way you've at least got some idea that they know the genre. The other thing is, instead of signing on the dotted line and being committed for a whole book, I do a few pages of a free sample just to see if this is a project that's right for me and if I'm right for this project. And then I have a short conference, fairly short because it's free, my time isn't usually, conference with the person I did the free sample with, and we talk about the project. And I can pretty quickly tell if we're going to gel and it's going to be exciting, and I don't care how poor the level of writing is, if I can work with the author and they want the feedback. And as long as they're clear, I'm not going to rewrite their book for them. That's ghostwriting. That's a totally different thing. Then I do a global read, the entire manuscript for $400, so that I know how it ends before I start doing a page by page deep edit. And most of the time when I give them the global notes, they have to go back and rewrite anyways. So why would you pay me per page for what is not nearly the last draft? If there's big issues that need to be done, characters that need to be merged because there's too many, scenes that could be merged, scenes that could be cut. It's big structural stuff. So they get a chance to do a rewrite based on the global overview and then bring me a book that is much closer to what the final is going to be. So then I can go ahead and do a deep edit. And by then we've got a relationship and we're having fun with it. We're excited. I love bringing a lump of coal and working with the author to squeeze it so hard that it becomes a diamond. And, I'm just as excited for my authors when they actually land a publishing deal, or when they self-publish and it's doing good. My friend Dorothy Kress just got the gold medal from the Northern California Publishers and Authors in the fiction section. And it feels wonderful. I love this job. It is the best thing that could have ever happened to me. And it kept me in writing when I thought I was going to have to give up as an author. And I thought I would be content always being a bridesmaid and never the bride. But it also finally led to my own book getting published.
How did you get into editing? I mean, what was that path like?
Oh my gosh. Talk about, the accidental tourist. This is the accidental editor. I had no even preconception of becoming a developmental editor. I had a day job and I was still writing on the side because I could not write. And I joined Gold Country Writers, which is a 70 member strong group in the Auburn Placer County area of California. And this group of people just are so encouraging. And the critique groups are so wonderful that I joined three different critique groups and I was going to their drop-in. Well, it didn't take long to figure out that this is something I really love doing. I had been part of critique groups for 20 years before I came into this group. And pretty soon I kept getting asked for critiques outside of the groups. Hey, could you read this short story for me? Hey, could you do these three chapters for me? And I wasn't able to write. I had a day job. And I'm like, I would, but I'm going to have to charge you. And I was shocked. People said, oh, absolutely. I don't mind a bit. What do you charge? And pretty soon I had a clientele that was enough that I couldn't do my day job anymore and do them. And then the pandemic hit. And luckily, my job was something that could transfer to Zoom and meetings. And so my day job went bye-bye and my editing job exploded. And I have really, really enjoyed the flexibility of it, but also that rush of discovering a treasure or the rush of rereading a manuscript that is from a C level to an A level just after the global read. And I just had that happen with a memoir. It was pretty rough and worked through all the stuff after I'd done the global read and talked it over. And she took a few months and rewrote it. And I was just jazzed because it was really good that it didn't feel like working. And when I'm quote editing something and it doesn't feel like working, then I know my job is done. I've gotten it there.
Yeah, most if you notice in the thank you or acknowledgments of most books, there is glowing praise for a person's editor, because I think that's the most important relationship that an author has, is finding the editor that they can work with, who gets what they're doing, who understands them, and loves what they are writing and helps it get higher and higher.
Well, and you just said the key word, the right editor. I won't edit historical romance because I don't have the expertise there. I won't edit erotica because I just have no desire for that. I won't do biographies, but I love a good memoir. And there's a huge difference between a biography and a memoir. But I also, you know, I will say no if the project just is not something I'm a good fit for. And, you know, that is something that editors often have a hard time doing because it's their livelihood. But nothing is worse for an author than having an editor who does not like the concept, is not into the story, or just is really difficult to work with and is not encouraging and is also, and this is a little harder to explain. There's a thing called vision. When you are writing something, and it doesn't matter if it is fiction or nonfiction, you have a vision for how you want that to impact your reader, or at least you should have a good idea who your target market reader is. And if your vision, what you want this to do for the reader, is not the same as the editor's vision, then it's not a good fit. That's not the right editor. And that's something you've got to figure out before you have them do the whole dang book and spend, you know, hundreds of dollars.
How, I mean, is that just a communication thing? How do you figure that out? You probably know that, but me as the author, I mean, say it's your first book and you've never worked with an editor. How do you know that?
So that's where and sometimes it won't be a free sample. Sometimes you will have to pay them, you know, $3 a page or whatever to do the first chapter and have them do just a few pages and then see what kind of feedback you get, see what they're like to work with. And just that short amount of working together will tell you whether or not this is something that is going to be a positive experience or a negative one. And so really comes down to don't commit yourself until you are comfortable that is going to help you. And so, yeah, whether free sample, a lot of people get their editors off of Fiverr, 5 pages for $5. And you know pretty quickly whether or not their work is any good. Now, the trick is you cannot submit your first 5 pages to one, your second 5 pages to another, your third 5 pages to another, and try to get your book edited for free. One, that's just shameful. But two, the most they could possibly be useful for would be proofreading for grammatical and spelling. That is not going to help you with continuity, character building, set development, and tension. I mean, one of the major things you really want to know from your editor is the story, if you're writing a novel, is it always building tension? Was the editor so engrossed that it was midnight and they needed to put it down to go to bed, but they just had to turn the page and see what happened in the next chapter? You get those kind of notes and you know your book already has a good grip on the reader. You can't parse out. And that's the problem with critique groups sometimes too. If you're doing drop-in critiques and you're bringing a section of the novel, it's only so useful on those, you know, few pages. But what is useful about it is that critique groups, if you're doing that, usually will make you present, or even in writing, the summary of up to this point. These are the main characters in the scene. This is what's happened before, and go. And if you can't put that in a few sentences, then you've got something that isn't really structured well enough, and you've got to look at what came before and make sure it's all necessary.
Yeah, I think writers trying to write a synopsis is the worst thing they can do. They don't understand. They don't really understand the basic motivation. They try to do linear things, and it's way too much information. It's like, what's the story about? That's what the synopsis.
Yes. And people who haven't been in the industry and haven't realized that what they're being asked for is pretty much the back blurb that's going to help sell the book. They're not asking for a plot summary. Okay. And so one of the things that I do with my authors is, as they are doing their rewrite, I have them keep a chapter outline. So this chapter, this happens, this chapter, that happens, this chapter, this happens. And then I go, okay, that is not what a synopsis is. But now that you've condensed the plot outline into 32 sentences or whatever, now we're going to try having you write a blurb. And when I went to the Iowa Writers Festival, there was a workshop for this. And I just really loved the worksheet that they used for it. And you can find these worksheets online. And it helped you just, who is this about? Where and what are they, you know, at the time of the start of the story, 1800s France, whatever. And what has interrupted their normal life? What has gone wrong? And then what do they need to do about it? The other one that is really useful is to have somebody else help you with the synopsis, because they really have an idea more of, I don't want to use the word theme, but it's the closest word I can get to. When you say what the story is about, it is giving the reader an idea of what kind of story this is, not telling them the whole plot.
Right.
I know of a person who used their critique group as the editor of their book and has gone through final production without ever having an editor touch it.
And that can happen. There are some times when, if you get enough feedback from people who are really knowledgeable and really give you some good feedback, the only thing I would say is that try to remember text gremlins, because every time you rewrite a book or revise a book, you can create continuity errors, you can create cut and paste errors, you can leave out, you know, articles like two. And so it's probably, even if you aren't going to shell out the money for a developmental editor like me, it's probably worth the $200 to $300 to have somebody just proofread to make sure it's clean, because nothing turns a reader off of a self-published book more than seeing on the first two pages errors. It shows a certain amount of sloppiness. And as much as I wish ProWrite Aid, which is the program I use, caught everything, it can't. It doesn't. But it is a useful tool for cleaning up your writing and learning some of the mistakes you make when it comes to passive language repetitive phrases. It can catch what a computer can catch. It's just a Grammarly on steroids.
What was that called?
Pro Writing Aid.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that one.
I got turned onto it from a fellow member of my critique group who does exactly what I said. He runs it through to look for specific things, passive verbs being one of the main ones. Because once again, why are you going to pay me $3 a page to circle every was, were, have, had, be, being, been, and say you need more active verbs? If you can have those highlighted so you can find them yourself, why not?
Yeah, they're... Literary agent Tony Lopopolo also does writing classes, and she has this list of the terrible 20 verbs if nothing else, put them in find in your Microsoft Word, and just every one of them, when it comes up, there's a better one. It's very rare that was is the only verb that'll work.
Well, and the thing that a lot of people don't realize is if you replace was with a more active verb, every place but where the was can have an impact as a statement of being, then it actually makes that stronger. Mm-hmm. So the reader won't go to sleep just seeing all the same verb. They'll have all this other more strong type of language and then a statement. And you use it like a punch, and then that's a perfectly fine place. But it's one in maybe 30, 40 was's that I find when I'm editing. And so it's a good thing to practice trying to avoid lazy verbs.
Yeah, we had someone approach us about working with them, and the first sentence of his manuscript was 5 lines wrong and had "I was" 3 times. You know, it was like, first off, this is about 4 sentences, and you don't say I was over and over.
Well, that's the other thing, an editor or a beta reader or a good critique group, a lot of times, and this comes from me having been the slush pile reader, that's a first reader for the magazine Amazing Stories, which was the world's oldest science fiction magazine. Oftentimes your story or novel does not actually begin on page 1 or 2. It's 4 or 5. And so having somebody else go, okay, this is where your story actually starts. All that other stuff you can filter in and give that info dump worked into the action. And figuring out where your story starts is a really tough thing that you're not going to get right on your first draft 99% of the time.
Yeah, it's like, I've heard this from enough people, and I find it true. You write all that, and then you try to find out, now, where does the action start? And you think like a movie. A movie drops you into the action. Mm-hmm. They haven't given you all, maybe the credits are running over scenery or different things of what's happening. So you know you've got the setting and location. But you don't write all of that. You drop the people into the action and then filter it through dialogue or narrative.
Well, and one of the things that, Donald Moss, I love his seminars, writing the breakout novel. He talks about, that's all fine in your zero draft. You're clearing your throat. Your first draft is you telling yourself the story. And some of that information might be absolutely necessary, but it's not necessarily needed in the first 3 or 4 pages. And if you find where your inciting incident is, you need to just put in enough so that we care what happens to the character in that inciting incident. And here's a good example. In my book, there's a character very close to the protagonist who dies very close to the beginning. And so at one point, I actually had my story start with that death. Now, that actually turned out to be a mistake because the reader didn't give a darn about that character. So what I had to do is set up the fear and the tension of what was happening and show how important that character was to the protagonist before I killed them off. And so that's still starting with tension and worry. And it also makes the reader believe that that character might not die. So then they're going to, throughout the whole rest of the novel, they're going to trust that you might kill off a character. So they're going to feel the tension It's kind of like Walking Dead's premise of just killing off main characters every so often so that the audience can't be secure. But you don't want to start with the body hit the floor if the reader doesn't care about the body, unless you don't want the reader to care about the person who just died and you are like murder mysteries. I mean, how often does it actually start from the perpetrator's point of view and just had killed his next victim before you jump to the detective who's at the scene examining the victim? They try to make you not be that worried about the person that has just died, especially in cozy mysteries, but now the story of catching the murder. So it's those type of things that you've really got to figure out what genre you're in and what your audience is and know what the expectations are. And if clients come to me, let's say that they've written a high fantasy, but all they've ever done is watch Lord of the Rings and they've never read any other high fantasy and they can't give any other comparables. And I think that's both on the editing side, and then when we start to talk about, you know, book getting published side, that a lot of authors don't realize how important it is to know your comparables. And those are books that are in your genre that are not identical to yours. You're not looking for a book that you just rewrote and put your name on it. It's in the genre in the sense that the exact type of reader that you are going after reads those books. So for example, I am working on a Murder on the John Muir Trail novel, okay, with a co-author. Well, people who read Nevada Bar, mysteries that are set in the national parks, are probably the exact type of reader we are going to look for with our set on the John Muir Trail. So that's a comparable. And that is homework that authors need to do in between drafts of their book. They should never go to publishers without or agents, because one of the questions right after, have you gotten this professionally edited, is what are your comps? Mm-hmm. And they really care about what your comps are. And I kept getting nailed because most of my comps were over 5 years old. So then I had to start looking at what's currently getting published, not what was getting published when I first started writing this. And it's worth the time to read a few of them to know what's going on, not to emulate it, but to be able to talk about your genre.
Yeah, I think writers reading is one of the hardest things for me to have a lot of people understand, because if you don't know who your market is, how do you know where your book fits?
And well, so many people think my book's for everybody. Like, but people think that, you know, they've put all this work into it and they're like, I like it, so everybody will like it. And I mean, that's just not the reality. Like, I mean, even as an author, like, you might write a book, but you don't like all genres.
What I always come back with is, do you prefer chocolate or vanilla ice cream?
Right.
And they'll answer. And I'm like, oh, so vanilla, if they pick chocolate, isn't for everybody.
That's a good way of putting it. I like that one. I might lift that.
Do you edit short stories or do you only do...
I usually like to do it with somebody that's going to be an ongoing thing that kind of fills in, because what I, with my work calendar, I do one global read and one deep edit every month. And then sometimes and this happens, authors are flaky and I am one, 2 days before the next month start, I will get a call from either my global read or my deep edit saying, I'm going to be a week late with my manuscript. And it's like, I can't be unemployed for a week. And so there's usually some short stories that can do fillers. Or I say, oh, okay, well then I'm afraid you can't start till next month. And the client who was 2-3 months off that's holding on to a done manuscript, I'll move forward. But yeah. And short stories are a good way to get to know an author.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I've been working on a short story. So I was just curious, like, if, you know, when you're editing, if it's just, you know, because editors like to read what they want to read. So, I mean, if you're only doing novels or memoirs, or if you also like to do shorter projects. And
short stories are a nice break. I think most authors don't think about using editors for them because they're never going to recoup the money they spend. You got to figure, I mean, even if they land a professional sale at 1 to 3 cents a word, maybe 5 cents a word if they're lucky. If they're paying me $3 a page, they're not going to end up making as much money as they spend having it edited. But that's what critique groups are for too. Now, if you're thinking about putting stories into an anthology, oh, absolutely have an editor go through, because what a lot of people don't realize, when you're doing an anthology of your own work, not a compilation of like a whole bunch of authors from Gold Country Writers, which I was the editor for our 10th anniversary anthology. If you've got a writer who, let's say I was going to actually do an anthology of all the first contact stories set in my fictitious Praxis star cluster. It seems like I could just pull all the stories I've written, the ones that have been published, that I've got the rights back, and just throw them together. That's not the best anthology. You want there to be some flow. You want there to be some building. You want there to be continuity so that they don't contradict each other. And you want to have an overall theme. The anthology I'm working with one author, actually has 5 themes. So we're breaking it into sections because it's all personal essays under a page. So that works fine. One will be, you know, life lessons. One will be family. One will be spiritual growth, whatever. But so that they're organized in a fashion that the reader doesn't feel jolted every time they turn a page.
Right. Well, listen, we're going on here, but we want to hear more about your book. So tell us about it.
So it's a book that I first wrote when I was 15 years old, set in a star cluster far, far away. And then when I graduated high school, I just kept getting told, oh, well, writing's a fine hobby, but you can't make a living at it. And so I was a good girl. I got a regular day job. I went to work. I went to college. I had a family, have a family, and then fell into editing. And I had kept writing as a hobby throughout it. But then when I met Gold Country Writers, it really inspired me to pick it back up. For the third time, I actually got to the very last selection process with one of the big 5 publishers who actually took unsolicited manuscripts and then wasn't selected. So that's 3 years just gone. And then one of my editing clients recommended me to his publisher, Black Rose Writing. And I did a rewrite again, because every time I edit, I learn something new. And I didn't want it to seem like a 15-year-old girl had written it, but I kept the character and the dialogue in her voice, because Twyla has lived in my head since she was 15. And the story is a genetically engineered young woman has been living in hiding on Earth. And the reason is her mother wants to use her telepathic abilities in their family business. And it just happens to be her mother is the head of the mob in the star cluster they're from, which is the Praxis. And so when the mom kidnaps her back to the Praxis star cluster and says, okay, now you're going to be a good Deconet daughter, that's her mom's last name, and you're going to become a Dashia, which is basically a psychic vampire. And she was raised by very good, wonderful adoptive parents who taught her right from wrong. So she tries to say no. And so I would say a lot of conflict ensues, including Twyla hating her own race. When she finds out what some people are doing with it, she actually becomes pro-genocide for her own genetically engineered race for a while. And then she meets somebody who makes her realize it's not the race that's evil, it's the ones who misuse the telepathic powers. But it's a fun romp into another, well, star cluster, 16 different races, and a lot of action adventure. And a main female protagonist who is everything I wish I was at 15. That's why I created her. And so it's been a lot of fun to retap into that character when I'm a grandma. Your perspective changes so much. And then to reconnect with a younger me. And now, I'm working on book 2, which that draft of the book is 15 years ago. And I'm like going, wow, I really sucked as a writer, but Twala was a kick-ass fun person to write about. So there's still something there that makes it fun to work with.
Sounds like fun. So I have a question. Is there a way people can reach you if they want to talk to you about editing services?
Of course. My website's nice and simple. It's ripartridge.com. And if you Google Rebecca Inch Partridge, I do believe my website is the first thing that comes up. And I have a contact form right there. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram. And now that new thing, Thread. God, I see it.
No threads for me. I don't do Twitter either. So, yeah. I mean,
mainly good to take a look at the website because I have my whole process there. I have a contact form, but they can also just email me at RebeccaPartridge@att.net. Got no problems with that at all. Just my name, RebeccaPartridge@att.net. And I'm happy to answer any questions. It is something I enjoy.
That's great. Now I have a sort of like to wrap this up on, let's go back to the editing because I think sort of been the focus of this podcast. What would be the top three things you would want writers to know?
So we've already talked a little bit about knowing the difference in type of editors. Know what a developmental editor does. Know what a line editor does. Know what an acquisition editor does. Know what a copy editor does, because you need to know what you're looking for before you go approaching editors, because some might tell you they do whichever kind of editing you ask for. But if you ask them what they do and they tell you developmental when you're looking for line editor, you know they're not the right editor for you. Number two, I would say, please don't publish your first draft. Please don't publish your first draft. Please, 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 God, don't publish your first draft. Authors shoot themselves in the foot by having a really great concept, a story with a lot of potential, and they're in such a hurry to give birth to their baby and send it out into the world of Amazon, and then they learn how to write. And then they go, oh, I should revise this. And they've already crippled that child. And it is really hard to get an agent or editor to even look at even a rewritten something that had already been published, because it's not first publication rights that you're selling. It has been out there. What I recommend usually in that case, pull that sucker off as fast as you can, write the next book, because usually they're doing it because they're working on book two and they realize that book one sucks. Pull that book one, redo book two, or finish book two, write book three if you've got the saga, then go back, write book one and change it enough that you can publish it under a different title, and don't even ever, it's no longer the same book. And the other thing is as an author, you really hurt your own reputation. When you've got friends and family who are willing to buy your book because they like you, and then you publish your first draft that is not up to the level of writing that you could get it to in two or three drafts, you're not going to get the word of mouth promotion that is still a huge part of sales. There is so much being talked about social media, social media, social media, and social media is great, but the number one indicator for sales is word of mouth. It's just word of mouth is switched to online sometimes. So you want people who read it to feel comfortable recommending it. And so it doesn't do you any good to sell 50 copies to friends and family if they aren't going to recommend it to another 50 people. So that's my soapbox. I'll stop now. Number three is just remember, tie always goes to the author. I can recommend any and all these changes that I might suggest. There's no reason to argue with me or to debate or try to convince me while I'm wrong and you're right. The book is yours. You're going to take what suggestions you want and you're going to rewrite that book that is truly yours. And I'm going to cry all the way to the bank with my check and be perfectly fine because you're the author. I know some people want the editor tell them what to do. That's not an editor's job. An editor's job is to point out problems. That's the diagnosis. And then at some point, if you're going that deep editing, not like a global reading, then to prescribe possible solutions. But you're the doctor who decides which prescription to use. And sometimes I'll offer two or three different suggestions how to solve a problem, and the author picks. But just remember, it's your book.
Well, I think that is probably the most important thing there, because a lot I've heard from different people that, oh, they're going to change everything on me. And it's like, no, you have a right. You know, they're suggesting changes they feel will improve it. You gave it to an editor to see how to make it better. And that's what you need. There's nobody writes the perfect novel first draft. Never happened in the history of the world.
Well, and the other thing is if you really, like when they say, oh, they're going to change everything, then are they a ghostwriter for you? Or are they your editor? Because they shouldn't be writing your book. They are just marking up your manuscript and putting in suggestions. Now, cleaning up punctuation and grammar, a proofreader, you know, you might have that. But yeah, editor helps you write a better book. They don't write it for you.
Right.
So your book is out now, right? It's available.
It is available on Amazon, of course, or Barnes and Noble. But because I do strongly believe in supporting bookstores, you can go to any of your local bookstores and order it just like you would any other book. And I hope that people will. Escaping the Dishia came out in March, and book two will come out next year.
Fabulous. Well, thank you very much for joining us. This was a very lively conversation on a
really good information.
Yeah, very good information. Very good information. This is the type of stuff we want our people to hear.
Well, it is important, and most people don't know they don't know. And just like how I didn't know all that went into a book launch when Escaping the Dishia came out, now I've learned a lot of that from listening to your show that I will apply to Abby's Fire, which is my next book that comes out on Halloween, because most people think a book launches the day it's released. They don't realize a book launch actually starts 4-6 months before that. And there's a whole lot of stuff that you don't do after. You have to have started and gotten ready before. So it's kind of the same with editing. If you don't know, you don't know, then you kind of learn the hard way.
Yeah. So there went one book down the drain because you didn't take the time to learn.
And what I'd like to think, because it's just within the 6 month window, I'm doing what I need to do with Escaping the Dishia at this point. But then when book two comes out of the Praxis cluster, then hopefully I will have learned how to launch it well enough that people won't just buy book two, they'll buy book one to go with it. But it's hard lessons, and it's hard lessons for authors that self-publish a book that hasn't been edited and then regret it. So it is lessons learned, and that's why shows like yours are so important.
Right. Well, and it's good with a series that they discover you at book two, then they like it, then they'll go back, and hopefully they'll do that wonderful thing of putting a review up on Amazon.
Hopefully. Absolutely.
That's the best thing. And any of you who are out there that read a book, get it on it, buy it on Amazon, and don't leave a review, you're really hurting the author, especially if you liked the book. If you didn't like the book at all, let it go. But if you really like the book, give it a good review. Give it a 4 or 5 star review, because that will make other people buy the book and they'll learn to enjoy it too.
And I think a lot of people think they have to do a whole essay. It can be 2 sentences. It doesn't have to be very time consuming. Just next time you're on Amazon doing a purchase, think about what the last book you bought. Go on, write 2-3 sentences and click the stars. And it does. It means a lot, you know. And my clients, I see them on Amazon checking like all the time. Oh, I got a new review. It also gives the writer a little encouragement.
You don't even have to leave sentences anymore on Amazon. You can just do a starred review. It's really easy. You just hit the stars and move on with your life, because even without, you know, the words in the review, it shows people when they're going to buy it, like, you know, you have 200 starred reviews or, you know, and on from there. Like, it's a really easy process to just hit the stars.
Isn't that like with a Kindle that at the end of the book, you can just hit a star and they do it automatically? I mean, that doesn't take any effort.
And your Kindle books do it automatically on both Goodreads and Amazon. So like if you read on your Kindle and you get to the end of the book and it asks you to leave a review and you do it, it goes to both places.
Well, see how much new stuff we learn?
That's what we're here for.
Well, we really appreciate it, Kathleen. And Adana?
Yep, Adana.
I wanted to make sure I pronounced it right at least once.
You did it. You've done it right all along. So just, again, just let people know your website, where they can reach you, you know.
ripartridge.com, or they can just email me at rebeccapartridge@att.net.
Perfect. Well, we appreciate you coming. This was a great conversation and good luck on this series.
Thank you.
That'll be it for this edition of Talking Book Publishing, and we hope you join us for our next one. Thank you.
Talking Book Publishing is brought to you by Writers and Publishers Network, a resource for writers and indie publishers at every level, and offers tools to be successful in their writing career. Writers and Publishers Network.com.